KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, President Trump is facing a bipartisan backlash for his pardon of former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was found guilty of criminal contempt for ignoring a court order in a racial profiling case. The controversial pardon came on Friday while Hurricane Harvey ravaged Texas. President Trump's ties to Russia are also under further scrutiny after reports surfaced that his company purchased a deal for a Trump Tower in Moscow at the same time he was running for president. Coming up on Forum, we talk with political journalists about these stories and other news out of Washington and more. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump is headed to Texas today to show support for victims ravaged by Hurricane Harvey and to assess the disaster relief, and it's the first major natural disaster since he's come to office. It comes in a week of controversy for the president. Details of his company's plans for a Trump Tower in Mexico while he was running for president, have come to light. And late last week, the president issued a pardon to Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was found guilty of criminal contempt for ignoring a court order in a racial profiling case. Joining us to talk about these stories and other news from Washington and certainly other stories in the news, Domenico Montanaro, who is lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience with National Public Radio. Welcome, Domenico.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you, and also good to have Julie Bykowitz back with us, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you as well. And Julie, let me begin with you, because there seems to be some irony pointed out by local Congresswoman Jackie Speier about the president going to Texas to show support for Harvey victims, very much in the news, when his budget calls for close to $700 million in FEMA cuts and $190 million in national flood insurance cuts, while threatening to shut down the government if Congress doesn't approve of $2.6 billion for a wall that Mexico was supposed to build.
Sure. And this always happens when there's a natural disaster. You've got the politics rearing up right away. Every president has faced something similar. It really tests sort of one of the aspects of a presidency, how you respond in times of national duress. The White House would like us to focus on President Trump's comments that he will fully fund any sort of recovery effort for Texas, which is still going through flooding, and the rain just never seems to stop there, and wants us to pay less attention to the overall budget issues. That is a really tough, path to walk. When he spoke yesterday, he did sort of repeatedly say it won't be a problem to fund the disaster relief efforts, and that, sort of trust him that he can get it done. And again, making very little mention of the overall budget and just focusing specifically on a package that the White House will put together of aid for Texas and Louisiana and other places touched by this storm.
Well, since you mentioned politics, and let me go to you on this, Domenico. Domenico Montanaro is with us, lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience with NPR. There seems to be some bipartisan backlash, particularly in light of the pardoning of Sheriff Arpaio.
Well, the Sheriff Arpaio backlash, President Trump went around a lot of the usual judicial review process. Normally, it goes through the Justice Department. There's a review to make sure that they're doing everything the way that they should be doing, that there, is some at least justification for doing what he did. He didn't even wait for the sentencing, which was supposed to happen in October. He just decided this is an 85-year-old man who has a wife who has cancer and who lived what he believed was an admirable life and was just trying to protect the citizens of Maricopa County. And that was Trump's view. And this was also somebody who obviously was a personal friend and an ally, somebody who he had known for several years, going back to the false birther conspiracy and how Trump had written him a kind of a fan letter saying that he thought he was doing a good job on that investigation and that he was running one of his own, and they became good friends and all decided to try to kind of hold hands and look into this. So there's a lot going on there, friendships, bypassing normal political norms, which we've become accustomed to, even though it's still not normal.
Well, I would actually refer our listeners to an article by Nathan J. Robinson in Current Affairs, which goes into the whole history of Arpaio and, you know, how he essentially ignored a lot of crime that was going on in order to really go after immigrants, both legal and undocumented. But that's President Trump in this bilateral press meeting that he had yesterday with the president of Finland. It's a curiosity that he has these. One was the president of Romania, now the president of Finland. One wonders what that statecraft is all about. But he brought up all these other pardons, the Mark Rich pardon by President Clinton, the pardon of Chelsea Manning by President Obama, as if to say, look, this is a president's right and prerogative, though it's earlier on in his presidency. Do you think, let me just ask you bluntly, Domenico, do you think this is also a way of saying, look, I have this pardon power, and if it comes down to Mueller naming names and bringing charges, I'm going to pardon people like Michael Flynn or whomever, including myself?
I do think that it sends a very strong signal to Robert Mueller, the former FBI director who's now running that Russia investigation, that if he's willing to use the pardon power for Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and the fact that he's trying to say, I have this power and I am willing to use it, if that comes down to, as you say, Michael Flynn or Paul Manafort, who was his former campaign chairman, or even himself. We do know that the president has looked into whether or not he could use that pardon power for himself. So, you know, I do think that part of why he brings up, you know, these other folks in Mark Rich or the other 139 pardons that Bill Clinton made on the very last day of his presidency is this old idea of whataboutism. You know, it's a way to shut down criticism and be able to not have to answer the ethics of what critics see as a problematic pardon.
And Julie Bykowitz, and again, Julie Bykowitz is with us from the nation's Capitol White House reporter for the Associated Press. Is it time mainly for some Republicans, as they see it, to take the gloves off with President Trump? And again, this bipartisan response to the Arpaio pardon has been pretty strong. Paul Ryan has come out in condemnation. How do you read it?
Well, it's a really interesting example of some Republicans, you know, openly sort of differing with the president on a particular issue. And I thought that President Trump's response yesterday when he was speaking about the Arpaio pardon and the timing of it all was rather interesting. You know, not only, as Domenico said, did he immediately sort of bring up other, you know, commutations and pardons by other presidents as if to say, you know, everyone else is doing it, so I'm just kind of doing what everyone else has done all along. But he also sort of responded very testily to this question about the timing of it. You know, was he doing it on the same day this massive hurricane was hitting to sort of bury the news? And, you know, he said that in his view,
he thought the ratings would be high.
He thought the ratings would be higher. It was very kind of an interesting and response for him to make. I have to think that the White House aides maybe took a different approach to that and thinking, you know, maybe this is a good time because the hurricane's sort of dominating the news cycle. But Trump was looking at it from entirely the opposite perspective, if we are to believe what he was saying yesterday.
And what do we make at this point, and let me go to you on this, Julie, of the timing about the Trump Tower that was going to be built in Moscow? It's a project that died, but there was a letter of intent that was signed, and there's a lot of things that have been coming out on that and coming out on perhaps his knowledge of meetings that Don Jr. had with Russian surrogate, talking supposedly about adoption, but really talking about dirt on Hillary Clinton.
Well, that is a really interesting development in the ongoing probes into Russian interference and what the campaign did and did not know about it. And one of the points that, you know, reporters who've been, you know, really staying on top of these things have been making is that it in some ways, you know, makes it much cleaner and clearer for Mueller to examine the Trump Organization's business dealings. You know, early on, you heard a lot of Trump supporters and lawyers saying, you know, it would be totally inappropriate for Mueller to expand his investigation into the business dealings. But, you know, come to find out, you know, with this very clear example of communication between a Trump Organization attorney who was also deeply involved in the campaign and another Trump associate with, you know, who was trying to get business deals done in Russia, it just makes it a lot easier to understand why the Mueller investigation might be sort of going down the business pathway as it looks, you know, all through the campaign and through the company for ties to Russia. And it just it sort of takes away this idea that the Trump Organization had nothing going on in Russia. You know, you heard that a lot from the president, from other Trump Organization employees and campaign people, definitely. And, you know, here we have a very clear example of an effort being made to do business in Russia. You know, no, nothing came of it, but they can't say that there wasn't some effort being made even during the campaign.
Which, of course, brings up the fact that President Trump during the campaign said there were no ties to Russia. There was no business really being done with Russia. And at this point, the two people you mentioned, Michael Cohen, his personal lawyer, and Felix Satter, a business associate, suggest that indeed there was a real attempt to put up a Trump Tower in Moscow. And a lot of this, of course, has to do with timing again. But let me go back, Domenico, to you. Domenico Montanaro, again, with us, lead editor for politics and digital audience with NPR. There's been, well, first of all, what about the president's threats to actually bring the House down with respect to there not being the revenue that he suggested the Congress should come up with for Mexico, for building the wall in Mexico, that, as I said earlier, Mexico was supposed to come up with the money for? The threat is out there now.
Right. And we will see if that winds up being an actual threat or if it winds up getting lumped in with something else or if he takes some half measure like a slightly more additional funding. He's not going to get all of the funding that he would like to build a wall along the entire border. But he's already, you know, backtracked on building a wall along every mile of the border. He's now said things like, well, there are rivers in certain places, there are mountains that are foreboding, maybe there'll be fencing in certain parts. You know, that goes without talking about the reason for having openings, which he said so that, you know, the agents could see through and, you know, you wouldn't want to be standing on the other side of the wall while a 60-pound bag of drugs hits you on the head. I don't know who's throwing those over the wall.
Well, now he's using actually the drug argument to a great extent. He's saying that they have that because of Jeff Sessions and the Justice Department, they've really curtailed to a great percentage the number of undocumented
coming
over.
Through.
Yeah. But you know, this is kind of talking out of both sides of the mouth, really. On the one hand, we have to have the money to pay for the wall. And on the other hand, Mexico is going to pay for the wall. And Mexico says no way, no how. And threatening the essentially government shutdown if Congress doesn't come up with the money.
Right, and we've already seen that transcript from the president and the Mexican president Enrique Peña Nieto, in which President Trump said to him, "Look, you know, basically, I understand your position that you're saying you're not going to pay for this, but just don't go out and say it. Don't tell the press this." And that's part of the Trump marketing and branding. He knows that this has been a big selling point, a big rallying point for his base, and he needs to be able to at least have the illusion out there that he could potentially get some kind of deal with Mexico to fund this in some direct or indirect way.
Indirect being NAFTA that he keeps bringing up. Correct?
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let me go back to Julie Bygowitz. And Julie, I'm interested in getting your thoughts about there's a looming sense that the Trump administration may actually scrap the future of the DACA admissions, deferred action for childhood, essentially the Dreamers, who were brought here before the age of 30. And the Republicans want it dead. And we could see, could we not, the deportation of as many as 800,000 youth?
Yeah, and this is a story that we've been following for days, kind of with the expectation that there would be some movement that we would need to quickly report. And so far, it's not gelling. So it's something that we're keeping an eye on. And you got to think, you know, maybe the White House is still kind of thinking through exactly how it would want to roll this out or how far they would want to go or if there's any sort of lobbying that's still going on within the White House, certainly.
But forgive me, there's a deadline now and a threat of going to court. September 5th is the deadline. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, September is going to be filled with all kinds of exciting political turns here, and this is just one of them that we're watching very carefully. We know people who are close to the president, you know, would like him to, you know, not act on DACA, you know, Ivanka Trump among them, and it just sort of remains to be seen how much people are willing to go to bat for a policy like that.
Ivanka Trump did not want the president to take the action he did on transgenders either. I mean,
exactly.
One has to
exactly.
ask what kind of power she or juice she has now. Yeah,
lots out there.
I'd also like to bring up, and let me go to you on this, Domenico, what's going on vis-a-vis North Korea. I mean, at this point, the president keeps saying we'll wait and see, and that seems to be the watchwords from him. But at the same time, three more missiles were fired. One was fired right over Japan. I mean, we've said before there may be no good options here, but what do you think is going on in terms of the White House response to this?
Well, the president certainly had a lot of bluster early on about this, to the point where a lot of people were wondering if there was going to be some kind of military attack, though we'd heard from the Pentagon that they weren't the lead on this, that it was the State Department that was taking the lead. But publicly, there was a lot of saber rattling, certainly. And it seemed that President Trump thought that he won at least that round of showdowns by saying that, that Kim had come to his senses very reasonably and decided not to, you know, attack Guam, essentially. But now with this new round of missile launches, the president and the White House put out a much more tempered statement, the only at the very end of that saying that all options are on the table. It was a much more traditional statement that I think you would see from most places, from most presidents. In this statement wound up saying that North Korea would only increase their potential isolation. And at this point, the White House does seem willing to go through the United Nations, given that they had gotten that unanimous resolution that they'd gotten through previously on North Korea.
So we're not the rhetoric has been toned down from locked and loaded and all the rest of that. But the rhetoric, yeah. If anything, in North Korea seems to have escalated.
In North Korea, sure. But, you know, if you're North Koreans, you know, not to be too far out of school with my lane here, but on geopolitics and American politics. But, you know, if you're a North Korean, leader, you're saying the only advantage that you have is having nuclear weapons and being able to have the threat of using nuclear weapons. Because if you're Kim, you see what happened to Gaddafi in Libya, for example, who gave up his weapons and then he wound up losing his life at a certain point because he had no more, stick to use with the rest of the world.
And they also look, of course, at the invasion of Iraq. We're touching on a lot of things here. And let me go to something that again, gets us back to an executive order, Julie Bykowitz, with you, and that is the lifting of restrictions on surplus military gear to police departments. Jeff Sessions said that the Obama administration, especially after Ferguson, went too far. And now, because of what he's arguing is better public safety, we've got all this lifting of restrictions. What does it mean? How do you see it?
Well, this is another example of something the Trump administration has really focused on in its first 7+ months here, which is rolling back policies that the Obama administration put in place, particularly ones that, you know, resonate very well with the base of voters that brought the president into office.
And there was wild cheering about this in Nashville.
Wild cheering about it, yeah. And so it's just in some ways the timing, again, you think about, you know, the things that the country is going through with racial violence and protests and statues. And it seems, and we're just coming off of a couple years, and we're still certainly in the thick of it, of lots of community questions about policing tactics. And, you know, to people who have been working on these issues, this feels like entirely the wrong direction. But like you said, there is a community of support for this, and the president has cleared the way for it. It's yet another example of an Obama policy that they're sort of gleefully wiping away.
And the president's support, Domenico, seems, at least where the base is concerned, not to have had much of a diminution. And there's those who are saying, well, you know, President Trump may have in the low 30s, but we've got precedent for that all over the world. You know, Macron of France is down to about 30% when he was up around 80, and so it goes.
Sure. You know, you haven't seen the base diminish at all, as you note. You have seen independents come down. Remember, Trump actually won independents on Election Day, and now they've flipped in the opposite direction of being far more disapproving of this presidency. But, you know, this is a president who's defied the polls in the past, and I don't think that the polling should be everything. It's certainly one data point to keep in mind. But I think that he believes the only poll that matters is on Election Day, to borrow that cliche, and he'll keep on going the same direction that he has been going without any kind of reach out beyond his base, because that's how he won election in the first place. And if he were to talk and act in any other kind of different way, he wouldn't seem as authentic to who he is. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of change from President Trump. I think he is who he is.
And Julie Begowitz, where is the Mueller investigation now at this point? It keeps moving forward. They have certainly been in many ways not leaking, but there's been a lot of suggestions about where they might be. Can you give us an update?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you're right. There's not a lot of leaking, which is kind of a stark contrast to the committees on the Hill. You have to say that you learn a lot more details from that group of people than you do from the professionals who are looking into this. There was a lot of activity over the summer, which makes sense. There's movement to kind of get what they can and move forward on the investigation. No one, including the White House, wants this to go on and on and on. The last sort of big public thing that we heard about the investigation was their treatment of Paul Manafort and, you know, just with agents raiding the home over the summer. And so there seems to be some movement on that front. And again, you know, I think that the developments, at least, you know, from the public perspective, you know, learning this week that there was some communication going on between the Trump Organization and people in Russia with regard to potential business deals, it does sort of remind people who are following along that there are these different strands of the investigation that can be pursued. You know, you've got everything from the actual interference that the intelligence community concluded Russia was behind during the election to and whether the campaign knew anything about that or any Trump associates knew anything about that, to potential business ties and deals, to, of course, also the, you know, potential obstruction of justice lane of things. So there's a lot, and it does seem to be moving. You know, again, you know, credit to Mueller. Nothing is really leaking out of there, so we'll all just have to wait and see.
Well, let me not wait and see what our listeners have to say. We've touched on and examined a whole range of issues that are in the news, and we do want to hear from you. We want you to weigh in. We talked about new revelations on Russian ties, about the budget, about the possibility of a shutdown of the government, the Arpaio pardon, North Korea, the future of DACA. I mean, like I said, we have certainly touched on a wide range, and you are welcome to join us. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. If you have a comment or question, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are talking about a number of news stories and news that has certainly been spotlighted and given attention to over the last week, and we do want to hear from you. Anything we've touched on is certainly fair game for your comments, as well as any questions you might have for our guests, Julie Begowitz from the Associated Press and Domenico Montanaro of NPR. Some of the questions that came up in the last half hour have to do with where the Mueller investigation is going, bipartisan backlash, is that going anywhere, but also the looming threats with North Korea and so many other things, the Arpaio pardon. If indeed any of these things are issues that you want to address and that you have some comments on, we welcome them, or any questions you might have. Again, number of ways you can join the program, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page. And I want to correct something I said, thanks to the listener who reminded me that it was not a pardon of Chelsea Manning. It was a commutation of his sentence, although President Trump did mention him at the press briefing yesterday under the Obama administration. Let me go to your calls. Let's go first to Boston. Michael, you're on.
Yes. Is it true what I've heard that if someone has been pardoned by the president for a crime, at that point they can be compelled to testify because they have no legal fear of self-incrimination?
Domenico?
I'm not totally certain about that, actually. I don't have the answer.
Julie, can you shed some light?
No, it's a fascinating thing to think about.
It's a very good question.
Immediately,
yeah.
No.
You know what? We have such an extraordinary audience. I'm going to ask if anybody in the audience knows. We have legal scholars and people, you know, who probably have the answer to that. Michael, thank you for the question. I hope we can get it answered before the hour is over. And let me go right to some more of your calls. Let me go next to Peter. Peter, you're on.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question, and that is, with all these revelations of the past month, really, it seems like it's leaning into a left hook that the Democrats should be taking advantage of this, but I've heard word zero from Pelosi, from Bernie Sanders, and I just want to know, as we roll into the 2018 election, it seems to me that this seems to be the kind of fodder that would be ideal to take back the House and Senate, which is, I'm assuming, what the Democrats want to do. But I want to know, they seem to be absent on these issues.
It's interesting. And, you mentioned Bernie Sanders. He may still be an independent, though he ran as a Democrat. But it's an interesting and an important point, and I thank you for it, Peter. Domenico Montanaro, where are the Democrats, Democratic leadership, particularly, you know, trying to dovetail off or make a good deal of hay off of these recent revelations?
Well, you know, Democrats are—they're not quite sure what to do with them exactly. You know, their instinct is to criticize President Trump and to look at what he's been doing and run against him and make him the referendum for 2018. The problem then that gets turned around on Democrats is, what are they running on for themselves? Like, what is the vision that they're selling for the country that's not just anti-Trump but something else? And they're going to have to make that balance. They're going to have to play that balancing act. And, you know, they have been trying to come up with an economic message that you hear. They aren't 100% unified on what that should be, is, you know, seeing that Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders, presidential primary play out, and watching the Democratic National Committee race play out. Democrats still have some issues to work out as far as what their unifying message is. And it makes it harder when you're out of power, because there isn't one particular person that you can point to say, this is the person that is our leader and who is taking us forward in the view of Democrats.
Have you weigh in here on this, Julie Bykowitz?
Sure. I think that those are great points. The party seems to be struggling to find its way forward. There's a lot of unification around opposing the president, but the box that Democrats are in right now is that their opposition is fairly meaningless on a day-to-day basis because they are not a party in power. And so they're thinking ahead to, you know, how can they succeed in 2018 and start, you know, taking back maybe at least the House, and maybe in some dream scenario for them, the Senate as well. And that's where sort of the rub is between, you know, can we just run in opposition to a president without having really sort of identified what the party stands for at this point, and how to make the case to voters that they're not just electing people who oppose something, they're electing, you know, people who stand for something different.
In light of that,
that's
actually,
what they struggle with.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but in light of that, I've just been thinking about Steve Bannon leaving his office, saying, as long as the Democrats keep bringing up race and sexual gender and all that sort of thing, we've got them. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And there's been a lot of sort of analysis of that and reflecting upon that, thinking maybe the Democrats have to stop emphasizing identity politics to the degree that they have been. Domenico, any reading on that from you?
Well, and that's the difficult part, because you call it identity politics, but what a lot of Democrats and base Democratic supporters will say is that they're calling out racism, and they're calling out what they see as cultural, you know, touchstones that are trying to be undone by the Trump administration and those associated with the Trump administration. It certainly fires up the Democratic base. The problem is that when it comes to independents and some of those whites, especially in the South, who they've been trying to and frankly, in the Midwest, where they lost in Michigan and Wisconsin, some of those older white men, for example, that those kinds of cultural issues and cultural sensitivities are not things that they get fired up about. They actually go the opposite direction and think that that Democrats are too touchy about these things and that they don't like the direction that the country is headed. And I think that as we head into this new kind of age of the American fabric of society, that it's very unclear what direction both parties are going to go. We've seen before where the parties have shifted not that long ago. I mean, 1980 really is when you could point to when those Dixiecrats really started to move in full force to the Republican Party. Where that's possible to happen again, I do think you're seeing a fundamental reshaping of the electorate.
Well, you look at the numbers. I mean, 47% of the voters are in the South, and some 80% of evangelicals are tied to Republican roots now and Republican partisanship, and those numbers are pretty astonishing. And let me get some more callers on here. Let me go next to Santa Clara and welcome Dan. Dan, you're on. Dan, are you there? He was right on point here. Wanted to know about rallying against anti-Trump. The Democrats ought to do that because of white supremacy. But let me go to some comments that are coming into us by email, and they both have to do with what we started talking about, which was Harvey and the politicization of Harvey and how politics are playing an important role in all that. I mentioned Congresswoman Jackie Spears pointing out the extraordinary amount of money that's been cut for FEMA and for flood insurance. And David writes, it's been widely known that about half of FEMA's positions have been left unfilled for years and that the vacancies are a serious risk to public safety. Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, I think that presidents generally need to show a degree of care, but not just care, competence when it comes to natural disasters in particular. And it's been a difficult thing for President Trump to pull off, to show that he has empathy, especially after Charlottesville. There were, you know, he didn't strike a unifying tone. He seemed to strike a more divisive tone. And that's something that he, you know, shouldn't really be, I suppose, that surprising given what his campaign looked like. But most presidents move on from campaigns and try to strike more unifying tones as president. And he really has struggled in trying to do that. And the competence part of this is a bar that maybe for him should be raised a little bit higher than it has been, because he's somebody who's touted his business experience, that he's a good organizer, that he you know, can manage. I mean, that's been the whole point of having a businessman as a president. That has always been the selling point, especially for Republicans, that they're the party of management. And if President Trump wants to show that he's a manager who's leading this new Republican Party, then dealing with a natural disaster should be right in his wheelhouse.
All right, I'm dealing with a little bit of a disaster here. I'm always trying to be the best and thoughtful broadcaster I can, but a number of callers or listeners said I refer to Chelsea Manning with the pronoun him, and I apologize for that. Quick correction, she is a transgender woman. Here is George, who writes, in your opinion, considering the limited influence they all have on the president, how long will it take before Jared and Ivanka move back to New York City? And what about Rex Tillerson? Have we ever seen so many departures so early? Julie Bykowitz?
Well, there's a lot of AP just wrote about this today. In fact, there's a lot of interesting dynamics going on with this cabinet, where you have Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis of the Department of Defense, and others, Gary Cohn, of course, is economic advisor, really just stepping away from the president's Charlottesville response, trying, you know, to varying degrees to put extreme distance between their approach to and what they think of America's strengths and, you know, what it means to be an American and what their president is saying. And that's really quite extraordinary. No one has quit over this or left, but, you know, there has been a lot of reporting about people thinking about it, people, you know, wondering how much longer they're going to be able to, you know, stay close to the White House and what that does, you know, for their reputations and so forth, how much they can stomach. It was interesting, you know, some of the other secretaries, Secretary Mnuchin, you know, really backing the president and defending the president's words in a way that others weren't comfortable doing. And then, of course, you fold in Jared and Ivanka, and what exactly you brought up earlier in the program, what exactly have they successfully been able to do to get their views in front of the president and have the president actually side with them on something? That doesn't seem to be going very well. And they probably are in a constant state of analysis of, you know, how much longer they want to stay.
Here's Jim. Jim, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. My question has to do with the Arpaio pardon. And I heard this comment the other day on some national TV program from a former prosecutor, federal prosecutor, saying that some people are thinking that this was just a message going out to the likes of Flynn and other people who potential flippers or potential witnesses against Trump, telling them that they have nothing to worry about, that he will exercise his right to pardon them. And so it pretty much insulates him from prosecution, because anyone who steps forward to cooperate as a flipper would be pardoned and wouldn't have to go through that. And I'm just wondering what your guests think of that thinking.
Well, it's thinking that I suppose is certainly understandable. Julie Bygewitz?
Well, I think that it's a difficult one to game out because there's no question at all that the president was highly supportive of Sheriff Joe, as he calls him. They're friends. They talk. The president genuinely believes that he's a good guy and that he sort of got a raw deal with this prosecution. So it isn't. It isn't as if President Trump just picked some random person to pardon. There's a history there between the two of them. And so it could be something that just is a clean pardon that he wanted to do and he exercised his authority as president.
Well, on forgive me, Julie, there's a history with Michael Flynn, too. I mean,
yeah.
And he kept asking, you know, Jim Comey and everybody else, you know, let him go. Don't go ahead with anything with him.
Exactly. I was going to say, on the other hand, it could be viewed as a sort of an assertion of, you know, I will have your back. I am a loyal person. And if you, you know, are loyal to me, I'll be loyal to you. And then, of course, you know, you just brought up Michael Flynn. He's a perfect example of this. There's been lots of reporting on the president feeling uncomfortable with how Michael Flynn was treated and wanting to have things turn out differently, regretting his decision to let him go.
I believe there's some movement now. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere, but either of you can comment on this if you know more than I do. By some Republican congressman in Florida to essentially make it off, well, again, put down a red line, so to speak, with respect to going into exploring anything about President Trump before his taking office?
No, I don't know about that, actually, but I would say that I think that they're not going to change much of what his presidential powers are for when it comes to pardoning or for, you know, trying to remove any kind of investigation. I don't think that that's on the table, you know, so he may be introducing this, but there are two investigations going forward in the House and Senate combined, plus this third with the special counsel, so with the FBI. So I don't think that that's probably going to go anywhere, because even though you hear President Trump try to say, you know, that he wants this investigation shut down, I think that Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, and Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, believe the best way for Trump to be exonerated is to let the process play out.
Here's another caller from Vallejo, Alexandra. You're welcome. You're on the air.
Calling because I wanted to ask a little bit more about the Democratic campaign messaging in 2018 and the talk of identity politics and cultural norms and kind of gearing that messaging towards civil rights, not just anti-Trump or anti-white supremacy messaging, but basic civil rights for everyone. And also That Bernie Sanders came and campaigned in Vallejo, which is, you know, a low-income community of color, while Hillary Clinton was doing fundraising, high-end fundraising in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. And if the Democratic Party was going to change their strategy a little bit more and go into these more downtrodden communities who basically were ignored in the last election cycle.
Alexandra, I think you've just outlined where a lot of the factionalism and split is. I brought it up when Congresswoman Pelosi was here in studio with us last. And Julie Begowitz, Democrats, we're talking about Democratic strategy here. They're going to have to think more about the working class and somehow appealing to the working class, aren't they?
Well, Democrats are in a tricky position for just the reasons that the caller brought up, which is that, you know, it takes money to run campaigns. It takes money to win elections. And Democrats have, you know, sort of taken, for the most part, with Bernie Sanders being an exception, a very traditional but uncomfortable route of raising money from big donors, which does fly in the face of the messaging that they have that there's too much money in politics. And I think that especially looking way ahead to 2020 and that reelection campaign, that's going to be really an acute issue for them because President Trump, you can say a lot of things about how he ran his campaign and but one thing that has been really just sort of noteworthy is that he was very successful with small dollar fundraising to an extent that, you know, no one before him had ever been. So that puts Democrats in sort of an even more boxed out position because this president is someone who has shown the ability to raise a lot of money online, sort of the Bernie Sanders style. And it's going to be really interesting to see how Democrats can continue to navigate that fundraising challenge.
And I thank Alexandra for the call and go right to another caller. And that's you, Ben. You're on. Morning.
Hi, morning. Just a quick two-part question. So I'm curious to know if, let's say, if the Robert Mueller investigation does find out that there was collusion between Trump and his associates with Russia, and then Trump does go ahead and pardons himself and his associates, is that then a dead end from a legal or a constitutional point of view, or are there any options that someone can still explore? And my second part is, if it is found out that the President Trump colluded in some way or the other and he does go ahead and pardons himself, is that still ground? Does that still mean that there's grounds for impeachment? I mean, is that an impeachable offense, or is that, again, like I said, a dead end? Hmm. I'll take my answers off.
Okay, there. Some thoughts from you, Domenico.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the thing is with impeachment, you know, it doesn't really depend on what someone does that triggers anything. It depends on whether or not the leaders in Congress wind up going and making the case to take that action and bringing it forward. And as long as you have a Republican Congress, you're not likely to see any kind of impeachment proceedings begun. Now, that said, if there was something like a clear-cut conviction that was then President Trump were to pardon himself and it was obvious and egregious and, you know, he'd taken a phone call from the Kremlin and was really a double agent or something, then maybe it would move people, you know. But I think it's very unlikely that a Republican Congress would move to impeach the president. And if the president were to pardon himself or either of or any of the people involved, if it came to that, then that is the end of the legal road as far as whether or not they go to jail or, you know, have a conviction that's stayed.
Perhaps the end of the legal road, but we could find ourselves in nothing short of a constitutional crisis. And it's interesting that Tony Schwartz, who wrote The Art of the Deal, opined that President Trump would resign rather than go to jail. And perhaps, you know, if there's enough out of the Mueller investigation to put him behind bars, and this is all very speculative and certainly premature, but we're talking about scenarios here. And I wonder, in fact, I'm looking at a listener who's bringing up the 25th Amendment. Does that have any traction? Julie Begowitz?
Again, it could eventually.
We ought to explain what the 25th Amendment is. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we're just talking about when a number of cabinet members are, and I don't remember if it's just a majority or if it's a supermajority, say that the president is not capable of serving any longer. You know, we're so far off from that it's difficult to even spend time talking about it. But as the investigation moves forward, and I'm thinking primarily of the Mueller investigation, which is the one that sort of has teeth, whereas the House and Senate investigations have a much more political dynamic to them. As that moves forward, that could start shifting people into different frames of thinking. But I just feel that it's too early and speculative to even really be discussing.
Well, a lot was made out of the fact that Bob Corker, for example, Republican senator, said he didn't think that President Trump was competent to be.
Yeah, but I really do think we need to reset for listeners that these aren't serious. I mean, these aren't things that are serious avenues. You know, what are serious avenues are the elections in 2018, the elections in 2020, and whether or not if Democrats want to win back power, they probably shouldn't be focusing on, you know, speculative things that are unlikely to ever take place and work on a message and, by the way, fundraising. And part of that does include big donors because they are going to need the kind of money to run campaigns. Barack Obama was able to do both. But at this point, you've got Democrats and the Democratic base who've decided that they want to shut off valves of resources because they don't think that they're ethical or moral to do so. And that's fine. They can do that. But it's like fighting a war with one hand behind your back.
And let me bring another caller on. Tara, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. My question today was about Trump's attacks on transgendered individuals actually increasing transgender people running for office. I know there's someone in Arizona running for the House, someone in Texas. I myself am running for California. I was just wondering your thoughts.
Any sense of more transgender people getting involved in politics, particularly running for office, Domenico or Julie?
I haven't seen in a particular increase, but that doesn't mean that when more of these issues are brought forward that more transgender people won't be running. And not to mention, you know, we hadn't seen the mainstreaming of LGBT rights except for within the last, 10 years or so. And, that started with the gay rights movement and being able to, win the right to marry in the Supreme Court. And now you're starting to see the cases dealing with transgender rights and the so-called bathroom bills that have now fired up some folks. And you know what the difference was with gay rights in particular when the public opinion really started to change was that more people who came out and the more people who were open, more people started to know colleagues or people or coworkers or family members who were openly gay. And I think you're going to start to see more of that with transgender individuals as well.
Let me thank you.
Yeah,
Tara,
I was going to just add to that. That just bringing these issues into the light, unfortunately, in a way that rolls back some of the opportunities, does bring people out that wouldn't normally be out there as voices for the community. And I thought it was interesting to see Secretary Zinke's daughter, who is a military person as well, writing a very sort of aggressive and mean Facebook post about the president after he made this decision. So you do see a lot more activism bubbling up when something like this happens.
Well, Ryan Zinke's daughter is speaking, shall we say, with more strong rhetoric than President Trump's daughter, who supposedly is on the side of transgenders. Here's Stephen, who writes, interesting political question for either one of you. Will we see Senator Cruz call for budget cuts before disaster relief is sent to Texas, or will this prove to be another flexible conservative principle? And will Republicans be able to push the relief through before Trump's Mexico will pay for the wall government shutdown?
That has not been the focus of Senator Cruz's comments, interestingly, this time around, as opposed to when disasters have hit other places.
Let me bring another caller on here. We go to Lisa next. Lisa, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I wanted to comment that for many people, the military equipment that's being supplied to their police forces might be something new. However, this is something that the black community in Ferguson had to deal with, who were basically protesting, which is a First Amendment right, and also especially the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, which were praying and trying to basically protect the water of 17 million people downstream, and who right now 700 people are facing very serious charges and Greenpeace and other organizations and people who help Standing Rock are facing a lawsuit by energy transfer partners. And the whole issue that's happening in Houston right now basically points in the direction there's incredible petrochemical spills that are going on because of these oil refineries, and basically points to the direction of what the Standing Rock water protectors were trying to tell the nation, that we need to change our direction. And I just wanted to mention that they faced a brutal military response by Tiger Swan, an agency that was hired by ETP and basically accused them of being jihadists and treated them brutally. There was people that were seriously injured as a result of the military response that ETP hired.
Lisa, many thanks for those comments. We're going to have to wrap it up after that, but I appreciate hearing from you. And actually, we didn't even we went into so many different areas of discussion here that we didn't come back to North Korea, but there are a lot of questions there that remain. We will have to cover these stories, of course, as we move along here. We just want to give you a good kind of sense of what is in the news and what is central in the news. And one comment from Robert, who said, your guest said this happens every time during a natural disaster that politics comes up. No, this does not happen every time, because not all modern presidents cut disaster relief or planning in budgets. And that's where we began. And let me conclude by thanking Julie Bykowitz, who is White House reporter for the Associated Press and examines conflicts, ethics, and influence at the White House and Congress. Julie, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you.
And thank you, Domenico Montanaro. Make that Domenico Montanaro, lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience with NPR. I actually got it on the first time. I don't know why I repeated it, but, you know, trying to be, like I said,
you just wanted to say it twice.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes trying to be the best broadcaster I can means repeating things.
Yeah.
Thank you, Domenico. And thank you, our listeners. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of the Minetti Schrem Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.